Okay, I guess we're there. So today's topics, well, we'll start where we stopped last time. I'll go a little bit more into some terms that I took a bit easily maybe on reliability and validity, which are essential terms. Then we will talk a little bit about survey methodology and representativeness of samples, and I'll give a little bit more introduction to the hand-in you have for next week. As I said, two terms which we, as I said, maybe took a little lightly last time was the terms internal and external validity. Validity means whether, in general, whether the results are true or not. And internal validity only actually refers to whether you have established a causal relationship or not within your experimental or test setting in some way. Based on what the input you have in that setting, regardless if the situation is a constructed one, whether it has something to do with the real world or not, it's only that you have established something within your experimental setting. While external validity means whether you actually can draw the same conclusions as you had in your experiment over to other settings, like to other people, to other places, to other times, to other circumstances. So can you move it out of the experimental setting or not? That's what we're asking here. That's what differentiates external and internal validity. Now, how do you, what do you do to make your study more valid? Well, of course, the ultimate thing to do in an experimental setting to increase internal validity is to have a very controlled study, or to do it in a very controlled way where you keep out all these noise factors that otherwise could challenge the conclusion you have, or that could make you draw erroneous conclusion about causal relationships, like in the example where we were studying whether an attitude campaign could reduce speeding on roads. Well, if you did that in a lab setting, it's probably very difficult to do, but if you did it in a lab setting, you could take out all these other factors like weather and light conditions and, well, maybe other factors as well. Not that it's doable, but anyway, that would be a very nice way to do it, to establish internal validity. And to even make things clearer, you can do as they do in the medical domain, for instance, do types of what we call double-blind experiments, in addition to having them blind, where neither the person that is the focus of your study, nor those who measure things, or those who distribute, for instance, the medicine, knows who gets what. Then it will take out a lot of factors. So, But that's in the, you say, this is on the extreme scale when you want to establish internal validity. In most cases, you can do much more, let's say, small things, at least to increase this internal validity, and that is to be neutral when you and be discreet use unobtrusive measures so that people don't necessarily know that they're being measured. So they can't react on it, for instance. So they behave in a the way they otherwise would do. Triangulation. Use different methodologies. Measure the same phenomena in different ways. Measure enough. Triangulation means look at things from different angles here. So these are all strategies you can apply to increase your internal validity. when it comes to external validity, of course, it's the tempting thing to do is to take things out in the in a real life setting. Move it out into reality. Move it into the context where you want to say something. The problem with those things is that the world is usually a messy place to measure things. Real life is usually a messy place when it comes to isolating a phenomena. So it's challenging. So the general, I could say, advice is to establish a relationship first, like establish good internal validity first before you do this thing and take it into a real life setting. But eventually, maybe it's you need to do it now and then. The next step is to use a representative sample, because if the population you had or the group you had in your experiment weren't the one you're going to say something about, well, then you also will have difficulties using them to generalize from. And of course, do replication. So one way of ensuring that the phenomena that you are actually that you have established, the phenomena that you have described in your study with nice internal validity, if you want to see whether that goes for other settings, well, replicate things. See to it that it's not just a one-time case that you're observing. So replication is a central thing to increase external validity, and it's also why we try to encourage people to not only do very new things all the time, try to do things maybe with a slight twist that others have done or you yourself have done before. That's also usually very good research. We haven't talked very much about, I know that, as I said early on, we have this bias towards quantitative methodologies in this course. We're usually referring to studies where we actually gather numbers and try to make things into numbers. In a lot of qualitative research, your focus is slightly different, or you try to understand phenomena more deeply. You conduct longer interviews. You yourself is the interpreter, usually, of the phenomena that you're observing. But still, there are similar strategies to apply there to increase the validity. Again, use multiple data sources, triangulate, use different methods, use a lot of time, see whether the phenomena is a stable phenomena. A single observation, a few people to study is usually not enough to may not be enough to draw conclusions, and use good descriptions of the phenomena that you're observing. You can take a look at these. There are a number of these things mentioned in your book, but also for qualitative research, the same phenomena or the same terminologies that we are applying goes there. We took this one last time, I think. So let's skip it and talk a little bit about reliability. Because you have the same stuff there when it comes to reliability. Standardization of procedures, for instance, is one way to increase reliability. That you have descriptions of your procedures that both for yourself and for others makes it possible to redo things and to establish the borders of what you are doing. If several people, and this is what maybe one of the largest challenges to low reliability in a number of studies, that the problem of different people that does the studies, they measure things, they draw conclusions in different ways. So make sure that all people involved in a study do things in a very similar way. That's what we are after there. Say, quite important way to both, at least to enhance, both to enhance reliability and validity, but also to investigate the whole feasibility of your study, is to perform some kind of a pilot study. It's very often, or too often, it's skipped. It's a very obvious way to check out things. Just check it out in small scale first. Try the procedures, try the instruments you're using. Try even the data analysis part. Do it first before you run the whole experiment. Running experiments is usually, or gathering data is a costly thing, both, well, mainly time-wise usually. It can also be equipment-wise. In your contexts, you have this challenge of, well, if you do things wrong, you may even burn out the access you have to test subjects. You tend to use each other as test subjects. And if you run things full scale right in the beginning and feel that you are doing it wrongly, well, then you actually burn out the access to these people because you can't redo the thing. So it's a good advice to pilot things first. Do it in a small scale first. See whether it's feasible. See whether it's you have chosen the right things to do. Mainly advice, but it's don't do the full scale things right away. That's my advice. Now to another topic, where we need to go into some terminologies again. Terminologies that we now and then go back to, that tells us a little bit about the what type of statistics we can use, what type of methodologies we can apply, what type of conclusions we can make from the results, and that is the type of measurements that we use, because data can be in very different or can come in many flavors. And we usually refer to this as a scales of measurement. Because data can be a continuous line of numbers, or it can be categories. And if it's categories, for instance, you use different method than you would if you were doing this as let's look at the different scales. At the you can see the easiest or most basic type of scale is what we call a nominal scale of measurements, which gives us an opportunity to do a little bit of statistics, but maybe not very much. A nominal scale is scales where you only, as the name says, only can put names on the different categories that you are introducing. Gender is the typical example here. You can't say that males are more than girls or something like that. It's just two categories. And then we have a nominal scale. This side of the street, the other side of the street, with or without a phenomena, maybe. That's typical nominal measures. You could still use a little bit of statistics on these things. You can you can count them. You can see which one is more common. You can show that in percentages, in ratios. You can do a number of things, and you can even do some statistics. You can calculate the deviations from random assignments into groups. If you're comparing boys and girls and with and without the phenomena, then you have a 2x2 table, which would, if you just threw all cases in there, you would have a pretty even distribution. And you can calculate the deviation from that even distribution as statistics. You can use a method like something called a chi-squared test. We'll probably do that when we do statistics, because at least a number. It's very common to have this type of nominal measures as independent variables in studies. It's a very typical independent variable. The next level up is to say that something is, well, it's still names, but as you increase the, the content of the name in some way, or the way we understand it, well, it's more of it. You can rank it. You can say that one name contains something more than the other one. Like level of education, for instance, where, well, you could, of course, measure it more in detail, like number of months you've been studying or something like that. But usually you use categories like this. Well, only elementary school, high school, college, higher education. And then you suddenly have a scale where you can rank things. So you can assign numbers to them, 1, 2, 3, 4, for instance, where 4 is always more than 1, which is not the case in a nominal scale. You can, when you have this, you can apply a lot more statistical procedures, like medians, for instance, the measure that divides the population into two. Percentiles, you can rank things and do statistics on it. If the numbers are high enough, you can even, now and then, you even apply more advanced statistical methods. But in say the general rule is that based on ordinal scales, you have some limitations. For instance, the usually the using a mean value with that you have 4.2 education on a scale from 1 to 10 here is usually not very, it's not a very common thing to do. But in some cases, at least when you have quest or answer categories, for instance, you can apply more of these. You can count some ordinal scales as if they were the next level up, which is then the interval or ratio scales. Because an interval scale is a scale where you even add more nuances, where you establish some kind of a zero point where the units of measurement is similar. So when you go one step up the scale, increase it by one, this interval is the same all the way up. So the space between 1 and 2 is the same as between 99 and 100, for instance, which wasn't the case for a rank scale, where you actually didn't know whether some of these were closer together. Your height, your the time you use or something like that is typical interval scales. These are continuous scales. Some call them also ratio scales, but the nuance between a ratio scale and an interval scale is, well, it's kind of diffuse, because you still use a lot of the same statistics, and for most contexts it's the same. A ratio scale has an absolute zero point, while the interval scale has an arbitrary zero point, for instance. But still, it's they are. You can use the same type of statistics, like means, standard deviations, correlations, t-tests, variance analysis. There is a number of procedures that you can do on that type of scales. But it's important to know what scale you have, because that puts limitations on your study, and it's also well, you treat them in different ways when you are designing an experiment, when you are drawing conclusions from experiments, when you plan things. So know what you're dealing with here. When you're doing this project here now, I will push you to gather data on different scales. You should have some continuous scales, and you should have some nominal scales, and maybe some ratio scales, so that we can actually see what we can do with these types of data. So remember this: what type of data we are dealing with. So again, just to sum this up on scales, the only thing you can say from a nominal scale is that the one thing is different from another thing. That's the categories we established there. An ordinal scale gives us a bit more, because you can say that one object is bigger or better or more annoying or whatever than something else. So increasing the value means adding to it. Higher value is more. An interval scale, of course, and the ratio scale then tells you that, gives you a more continuous way to measure the difference between objects, etc. The next topic we are looking at today has to do with gathering data in a very, or the most common way that you will be using, at least if you are doing studies that involves people, is to gather data from them by using some kind of a questionnaire or something. This class of methods is usually called survey methodologies, where you try to measure a specific state of a phenomena out there in the society in some way, or among a subpopulation. It can be done in very different ways, of course, from face-to-face, long personal interviews where you sit in front of each other, and via the more, well, calling people, mailing out questionnaires that people are going to fill in. But the most common thing to do today is, of course, to do this in an electronic format. And I'd say one of the reasons we spend a little time on the phenomena like this is that there are different qualities to these things. If you do electronic surveys, which is of course the obvious thing to do today, you may do something, you may measure something different, and you may have biased results compared to what you had when you were doing it in the old fashioned way. And the easiness of doing surveys as well, that we have today, where you have all these tools on the net. Google has tools for this, QuestBack. There is a number of different tools, and you may have used some of them. It's so easy to use it that so many people use it all the time. So response rates on questionnaires like this has dropped dramatically from what we had in the old days. And we have huge challenges when it comes to representativity of populations today. Of course, there are a number of advantages still in electronic service. The main thing is, of course, cost. It's very easy. It's more or less free to do it. It takes a little time to set up the questionnaire. But when you do that, it's only a question of making people look at it. So it's both time and cost-wise very convenient to use. You can reach a wide audience. A lot of people can be invited to your questionnaire to answer it. The data, when they come in a ready, more or less chewed format. It comes back in numbers, nothing you need to punch or recode or do anything with. So you have it as ready data right away. And of course, web-based surveys can look nice. And you can be flexible. You can have different designs for different groups. You can do a number of things there. Of course, there are a few disadvantages as well. One is probably handled in a pretty nice way today, and that's the thing about privacy and anonymity. There is a challenge that you should be aware of. For instance, using questionnaires or sending out questionnaires in quest back, and maybe in Google's tool as well. I just forgot the name of it now. What's it called? Google Forms, right? By default, to check that the same person isn't answering over and over again, it usually does an IP address check and includes an IP address with the answers. By actually reading that one, you may trace the questions back to who has answered the questions, and it raises a few ethical concerns, and it's mentioned as an ethical difficulty in the guidelines we have for ethical conduct of research. So be aware of that one and remove actually the IP address. That's the general rule there. But in general, you can do this. You don't need to know who answers your questions, so you can ensure pretty nice anonymity and privacy. And it's usually very unobtrusive. It's not a big invasion of your personal sphere in any way when you ask people to answer questions. But the problem is the response rates. In the good old days when one did surveys and sent out questionnaires to populations, you could, even without following things up too thoroughly, you could probably get response rates well above 50%. When you send out questionnaires electronically today, you will be, well, you're lucky if you reach 10%, but usually you will reach much lower numbers than that. And as we will get back to, the people who actually answers these types of questionnaires tend to be very skewed, a skewed population, a very biased population. So drawing conclusions from these types of from questionnaires where people themselves choose whether to answer or not can be very difficult. So if you want to make sure that you get answers from a huge population, or from the, not from a huge population, but from the right population, and from as many as possible within that population, let's say within a school, or if you're doing some kind of a study on a class of students or something, by sending out questionnaires, you would probably get response only from a very few in that class, from that class of 30. But by interviewing them face to face, you would get answers from most of them. And of course, then the population would be much, much more representative, even though you won't get that many respondents. Those who respond will most certainly be be the right population to answer questions. So consider alternatives to the convenient electronic strategies today. And of course, the challenge here is the thing with representative samples and how to get there. We can use this very old example, which in many ways illustrates the. Let's take another one. Let's take the before the break. Let's take. Something like this. This is a very common way of doing it. You could say that this is one way of This is very in the media now. You have a lot of these very simple, straightforward methods. When we ask questions and people can either phone in or just tap a link or something like that to give answers to a somewhat straightforward question. And in this case, in this program called, I don't think it exists anymore, does it? Holmgang? But it wasn't very long ago where you had it. And it, you always had this, with you. I think it's probably some clever strategy to involve viewers. So you ask a very straightforward question that can be answered only in two ways. No nuances here. So it's either yes or no. And in this case, the question was: should Norway close its borders to refugees from other distant countries? Do you agree or disagree? That's an easy question, right? So, and usually the answers in these types of studies, they come out kind of clear. In this case, nearly 90% said that they agreed to the answer. While only 10% said they disagreed. The numbers don't add up here, do they? It should be 10.6, shouldn't it? But the numbers, you get the idea. You have a very clear distribution. And you also have an extremely huge population. Because this is convenient. 40,000 people went into this or answered this question. And of course, it's easy then to say that, well, 40,000 people, they must be representative of the big population out there. Because getting that type of response numbers is very, very uncommon to get in most settings. At least when you do studies, you will be lucky if you get 50 or something. But of course, this can be done in different ways, like we do when we do different types of polls. When you ask people what political party they vote on, we have a number of these now. And the one of the Norwegian census bureaus that's measuring these in a professional way, they ask the same question, but instead of asking everybody who wanted to participate to actually participate, they asked a subpopulation. They asked only 600 people, but they knew who these 600 people were, and they followed them up. So they got a nice response rate from an audience which they knew. And when they did this in this population, they got a very different type of answer. They got 77% that agreed, 16% that agreed, and 77% that disagreed to the question. They even added a, I'm not sure, category. But that one actually didn't get that many respondents. So you have a completely switched around result. And of course, the last one is the true one. The first one isn't true at all. Even though the numbers there, the number of respondents are way, way higher. But of course, why do you think this happens? Course, that's the type of self recruitment to these types of service is so large. It's only those who actually cares or actually watches this program in this case that does it. Yes. Yeah, some of these had also had that, so we had another filter that kept some away from this. So this is a self-recruitment to studies, as we have, tend to attract only those who either have an opinion, have a strong opinion of a phenomena, or cares about it. The rest of us who is not that interested and don't have very strong opinions, well, we just skip answering these things. And maybe some of the conclusions you draw from a lot of these, the answers you get to questionnaires that you're invited to participate in, you can think about this yourself. What type of service do you actually say yes to participate in? It's usually those that concerns areas where you have interests. Like if you're interested in particular types of technologies, for instance, and you get invited to say something about your how well you like this type of technology, well, then you will most likely answer these questions. If you don't care much, well, then you will drop it, probably. I think we'll take a break there, and I can rest my voice. I have a little bit of a challenge with my voice today, if it drops now and then. So let's start 15 minutes past 9 again. Okay. One more example that just points to some of the problems we have with both self-selection and the general procedures we can use to select people to participate in different survey methods, and that the point that I'm getting to here is that drawing valid conclusions from surveys have little to do with numbers, or the big numbers or big number of respondents. It has to do with reaching the right respondents. And a very famous example that put this problem on the map was a very early big effort to predict the outcome of an American presidential election back in 1936. And this was in the early days of these types of statistics. And it really pinpoints the problems that we may have when it comes to getting the right population to answer our questions. And this example comes from a big, at those days, American magazine that tried to have its readers, and for that sake, Americans, to answer a very easy question: who would you vote for the next presidential election? They predicted that the Republican Landon would get 57% of the votes, while Roosevelt would get 43% of the votes. But a landslide occurred, and Roosevelt actually got 62% of the votes, not 43, which of course switches the whole picture here dramatically, and the result from the poll, which is a survey methodology, was completely wrong. But the interesting thing is that this was a big project. 2.4 million voters answered the poll, and just imagine such a big number. It's what an effort this must have been to do this. And it was also very difficult to do. So the method they used to get these 2.4 million respondents was that they invited people from phone registers. They invited people from car owners registers. They invited people from their own membership lists and other organizations. So this was a collaborative effort from a lot of people to invite a lot of voters to respond to this poll. And they sent out actually 10 million questionnaires, invitations to participate in this poll. They got 2.4 million back, which still is kind of good today. 24% response rate is that's something you would consider phenomenal if you invited people to participate. As I said, you're lucky if you get 5 to 10%. So still this is a this was a huge effort. So, but it went wrong. They asked so many people. Any ideas what went wrong here? Based on this method, what do you think went wrong? Well, of course, we can take the obvious one first: self-selection. That's probably one here. But that's not the most common one that we refer to here. Yes. Yeah, there are some biases involved here, right? They used phone registers, for instance. And who are more likely to own phones? At those days, who were most likely to own phones? Probably, there's probably some socioeconomic factors involved here. So those who had phones were probably more well off than those who didn't have phones. They had some, there were already, in the selection process, there were some bias here. And if that underlying bias had something to do with the poll, for instance, these middle class or higher middle class people, I don't know who they were probably more likely to vote Republican than for a Democrat in this connection. So the selection procedure itself created a problem here. And this will of course also be the case in many of your types of studies where you invite people from your own interest groups, from Facebook. You don't get the general population, you get some kind of skewed population in some direction. And this makes it of course difficult to draw conclusions. And the same underlying phenomena here for this thing, we took phone registers as an example. Car owners probably had the same bias. People that actually were members of organizations and paid to be there probably had the same bias. Bias is a tendency towards one direction. So you had the same underlying phenomena for a number of things here. And this is, of course, why this went wrong. So it's actually no safety at all in big numbers when it comes to representativity of samples. So how big should a sample be? Well, it can be... The general rule is... you have to do some kind of a sampling from a population. But... And at a certain point, there is no safety in adding numbers, or there is very little reason to do that. I didn't do anything, did I? There is very little you can do with that. So if you have a small population, ask everybody to participate if it's less than 100. If it's more than, let's say if it's 500, ask half of them to participate. If it's 1,500 people, that's your general target population, ask about 20%. And if you have a population that's larger than approximately 5,000 people, there is little reason, if you have good sampling methods, that is, to have a population that's a sample that's much larger than, let's say, 400. That's a rule of the thumb here. But it's not very strict. But big numbers doesn't help you in getting representative samples. Because there are of course other factors that affects this as well. If it's a very homogeneous phenomena that doesn't vary very much over the population, well, then you can ask a smaller set of the population than if it's something that varies quite a lot, and that's maybe also ruled by some underlying problematic factors. We know that a number of factors tend to have an impact on the results in questionnaires. So these are factors that you in some way need to either ask for or control for when you do your sampling. And that is things like gender, age. These two are commonly used in all questionnaires, just at least to check whether they have an effect or not. Where you live is another one that may have impact in many situations. And also various other socioeconomic factors, income levels may be important in many cases, education, a level of education, the type of job you have may be important. So there are two ways to do this. You can either make sure that all these are represented so they are nailed out in some way, or at least you need to see if there are any, if you get any skewnesses in your population based on these numbers, so you need to measure them. And you can also control for them statistically later. That's what a lot of statistical procedures say handle this situation quite well. So how do we make sure that populations are representing, or subpopulations are representing, the population we want to say something about? How can we make sure that the sample we have actually represents the population we want to say something about? And we can say we have two main categories, or two main methods to apply here. One is called probability methods. The other one is called non-probability methods in doing or sampling from a population. The golden methodology here, the old good methodology to use was, of course, this probability methods. It means that any member of the population have the same chance of being part of a sample. So the chance is equal for everyone. But in order to, and what you do then is just to do random sampling from a huge list of numbers or names. But in order to do that, you need to have a large database to sample from. And most of you won't have access to these things. The census bureaus, especially the national ones, they have these big databases of all Norwegians, for instance, all residents in Norway. And based on that, you can do a lot of good sampling, so you can apply these types of methodologies. And they can even do what we call stratified sampling, which is to make sure that every subpopulation is represented in a controlled way. So you first draw among all men, and then draw among all females, for instance, or some other criteria, age groups, age segments, for instance, that you want to be represented. That's still a probability method. What most of you will be using is belonging in the other category called non-probability methods, where there are challenges to this idea about everyone having the same chance of being part of the study. And one of these things is what we call convenience sampling. And that is what most of you probably will apply when you do a service. And that is, one way of... You use the people you have access to. That's the basic thing in convenience sampling. You have a number of friends on Facebook, and you invite everyone to take part in your study. You have some fellow students, and you have some forum to access all fellow students, some arenas where you meet them, and that's the participants you use in your study. So fellow students is the most common group of test subjects or groups you actually use in all types of a number of studies. I would say unfortunately, but again, it's a population we know a lot about. In my area, for a lot of the issues that has to do with human social performance, how we behave in groups, how we fail to take or draw correct conclusions from our environment. Most of these types of conclusions comes from studies that's performed on American psychology students in the 60s and 70s. So you could say that it's a very biased type of population and not very representative maybe. But still, it's a population we know a lot about, so at least we can say something about them, and then it's a challenge to see whether this goes for the rest of the world as well. But Indian sampling has challenges, as I said. We are not completely sure when we do use convenience sampling that we actually have represented the population we want to say something about in a good way. So keep that in mind, discuss it, but don't let it stop you. But of course, it raises challenges, and it challenges you to discuss it in different ways. There are other, let's take the most maybe extreme biased way to do things here, but still kind of useful. And that is what we call snowball sampling. That's I mentioned this because it's a method that some of you may want to use when you choose your test subjects, when you try to find someone. Snowball sampling is a strategy where you find one, and based on an example that you find, you attract others. An example is when you study some phenomena that's not very common, and a lot of you will do that. You will study fraud, you will study gamers, you will study maybe addiction phenomena, which is not necessarily anything that everyone has. Those who plays, let's say, excessive gamers that spend 10 hours a day on a regular basis playing a typical or one type of role-playing game or something. It's not a phenomenon. It's not probably not very useful to ask a big population about this. It's highly unlikely that you will find this person among, or you will find very many when you ask a general population. But maybe you know someone who is in this group. One in the very little segment of the population that we're after, one of these 1% that represent 1% of the population maybe, that is an excessive gamer. If you know one of them, well, you can ask him, and he's probably a member of a few fora or something where there are other gamers. And based on your knowledge to one, well, you can meet others, and they can meet others again. And that's why it's called this snowball sampling method. You start rolling a small ball down the hill, and it grows and grows and grows. So it's a valid strategy. It's very challenging, of course, to draw conclusions based on this to a general population, because it's not a, you haven't actually sampled from a general population. You have just taken a very small subset of the population. But you can say something about these gamers. So you can say something about the very narrow population that you actually have focused on. So it's still valid, even though you can't generalize to this general public. So in general, the higher you are on this list, the better it is when it comes to general representativity, but well, you don't have access to, usually you don't have you don't have databases that allows you to do probability sampling. So you need to do convenience sampling, but even when you do convenience sampling, make sure at least that you measure some of these background variables so that you can control for them in other ways and at least describe your population in a good way. Another problem when it comes to the type of answers you get is that we are, as humans, extremely good at, and this is something we tend to do all the time, we try to find the underlying causes for people asking questions. Why did he do this? Why did he ask this question? We try to put things into context, consciously and unconsciously. So why do they ask these questions? What does he expect me to give as an answer here? And even if I give an answer, what will the consequences be? If this is about how I do my work and how many hours I spend at work every week, well, I may have strategic reasons to say I spend very many hours a week at work, because this goes back to my boss in some way. So I tend to answer according to my interpretation of the questions that's asked. It can come in different, you could say this bias can have many different the implications or results. It may lead to, and this is of course can be a nice thing, that the response wants to be nice to you. They, if you were the one who asked the question and you asked the question about maybe some software you have developed or taken part in developing yourself, and this person wants to be kind to you, well, then he answers more positively than if he were neutral, for instance, in this. But you may also have more or answers that goes the other way. Maybe where he wants to oppose you because you have a role or that someone wants to oppose to. So the point is, you don't know necessarily where this bias takes you, in what direction this answering bias will take you. But what you know for sure is that people will try to interpret why you ask questions and what you're after when you ask questions. And very small nuances tends to be, detected there. The example that I'm going to give you now is a pretty famous one. It's from a study where it's one of these studies where they want to find out about biases in the decision-making process of humans. Of course, again, done on American college youths. A pretty simple experiment. Groups of people were taken into an auditorium or into a room where they were looking at a standardized film sequence. Kind of a small film sequence where what they were looking at was whether, or what was a situation where a car were hitting another car from behind, in front of a traffic light, I think it was. So there was a small collision there. And of course, these people were then eyewitnesses to this collision. And after they had seen it, they got questions in different formats. But they weren't very different. They just varied with one little word. They were asked, well, what you saw now was the film sequence where one car, and then comes the trick here. They said, contacted another car, or they said hit, or they said bumped into, or they said collided into, or smashed into another car. So the only little thing they did was to change this one word in the question. And when they did that, and then the second part of the question comes, how fast did the second car drive? You're an eyewitness, you're to observe this. And they got a very nice linear function. The stronger the verb they used, the higher they estimated the speed to be. So, I think this is Palmer and Loftus who did this study. They did a few variations in this case as well. For instance, this goes maybe outside this context, but they let a little time pass, and then they asked people how much was the first car damaged, how many, what did they see, how can they describe the damages on the first car. And the stronger word they used in the first context, well, the more likely they were to see huge damages on the first car. They saw, I don't think there were any, actually. So it was a very discreet thing. But the stronger word, well, the more likely were to remember the situation differently as well. So they saw more damages. So just an example, we are extremely sensitive to this type of wording that we use. And, of course, we need to be aware of this when we ask questions in questionnaires. This goes for all types of studies, not only questionnaires, and a word that we use now and then to describe this thing is demand characteristics. That we tend to act according to what we believe is required from us. A huge bias just for all for surveys and for other types of experiments at all as well. There are ways to deal with it. Of course, you can be very good when you ask your questions to make them. Well, you hide the reason for asking the question. If you're looking for some specific phenomena, for instance, don't ask about that phenomena right away in your questionnaire or in your interview. Try to hide it in some other garbage. Ask a number of other questions before you get to the question that you're really interested in. So hide the connection in some way. Use false information raises all kinds of ethical concerns, of course, and we'll get to that. But there are strategies that you can apply to try to avoid this problem of demand characteristics of in experiments. No, I have a number of slides here that goes to how you should make questionnaires good. I'll see what I can use or talk about next time when it comes to that. But I promised also to say something about the the assignment for next week. As you have seen, you are to look at two different papers, small papers, that in some ways, they're very different, of course. And there it's a different, because there are different challenges when it comes to finding dependent and independent variables and discussing reliability and validity in them. One of the articles is, you may have seen it already, is this short thing from the Journal of Improbable Research. Kansas is flatter than a pancake, where they try to use scientific methodologies to check whether that is true or not. The other paper is a paper where I and some of my colleagues, based on some work we did a few years ago, and I thought that I maybe should try to give this, or at least some small version of a presentation that we gave on this on the conference. And that has to do with how internet connected devices are used in a lecture context, like the one we're sitting here now. Some of you have computers. Some of you have other devices, and they're probably all on the net now, which would be, it would be kind of stupid not to. And you're probably doing different things on them. You can close down your games now, because that's what we are. That's what we were looking at. That was one of the things we were looking at. How is this use interpreted among peers in the auditorium? Is this a problem? Those are parts of the questions we were asking. So, very short about the background there. And this is a typical small study. Presented in a format that's pretty common. It's a conference format where we made a short. We made a couple of papers out of this. One large that came in a journal, and one small one which was presented on this conference. And the background for the study we did then was that students did. Even 5 years ago or 7 years ago, access the internet during lectures, which worried some teachers, which was found to be a very big debate in different seminars. How should we control? Should we control for this? How should we use it in a good way? There is a reoccurring discussion on should we block internet access during or filter internet access during lectures. We somewhat took a step back from that and said that, well, no matter what we do, at some point, this is unavoidable anyway. Especially when we did the second part of this, where it became quite common to also to, well, it's kind of new that we have, even if we try to block internet traffic, we can't do it because everybody has it on their phones anyway. So it's unavoidable. People use computers, use tabs, use phones during lectures anyway. So the best thing we can do is to give advice for how to use it, and the may be some of the challenges when people use it, and to know a little bit more about why people are using them and why some don't. Because a lot of you, all of you, have access to laptops today. I would find it kind of strange if that wasn't the case, but not all of you are using it during lectures by some reason. So we also wanted to try to investigate why, what reasons are people giving for not using computers. What we did was that we had, during a number of classes, what we could call a representative sample of courses on this campus. We were observing an ordinary lecture. And right after the lecture, we said, oh, please sit quiet a little bit. And then we distributed questionnaires to those who were in the auditorium. And we had slightly different questionnaires to those who were using computers and those who didn't. So we had, you could say we had two groups here. We had a group of users and we had a group of non-users of computers. And those were the, I'll try to avoid saying whether that is an independent or a dependent variable, maybe, because that's what we're asking for here. So what we did was we had users and we had non-users of computers. And we had them say something about why they were users and non-users, and we had them to comment on or rate the type of behaviors or the way computers were used during classes. So those who were non-users were, for instance, asked how much did you see of what did the computer users do? They were asked, what did you see the computer users do? While the computer users, they were asked, what did you do? So there were slightly different questions that we asked. And of course, what we were after was, did they see different things, and did they interpret things differently? We had a nice sample, 210 students in total, in 70 females out of those, so there were a male, overweight of males, saying something about the, maybe this wasn't a very, maybe the types of classes weren't that representative. We did it at two times. We did it once in 2007 and once in 2011. So it's a few years ago. We did this to see whether things had changed over these years. The questions, as I told you. But another thing is that when it came to the observations of their own or other students' behavior, we tried to group the types of activities into what we could call academic relevant activities and academic irrelevant activities. Whether they used it for something that had to do with the the course, or whether they did just use it for older things, checking emails, going to Facebook for a quick look at update on this their life, playing games. So those were typical non-relevant activities. So of course, the question was, did users and non-users of the technology observe things differently? This is just some background results here that has to do with usage in general. The number of people using computers during class seemed to be very stable. Some 30% did it, which, if you look around in this class, is probably quite near the result or near the situation we have today. So this actually hasn't changed much. Some 30-40% uses it. This is based on experience. What had changed from that's an interesting thing from 2007 to 2011 was that now in 2011 everybody had access to computers. So none said that they didn't use it because they didn't have access. Everybody had. So that had changed. So the it seems like the reasons people give for not using is kind of stable. The users tend to be also using computers more in their older the rest of their life. So they tend to be more using more computers in general. Now, to the interesting things on the result. So what we did here was that we looked at the relative time spent on, we asked, as I said, computer users and non-users about how much relative time did they spend on non-academic activities compared to academic activities. And the interesting thing there was, of course, that computer users, well, they said they used most of their time actually on academic activities and a lot less on non-academic activities. While the observers saw a completely reversed situation. They saw a lot of non-academic usage. They saw less than expected academic use or academic relevant use of computers during class. So we don't know what the truth is here. And this was the point in this study. We don't know what is true. We just know that there is a difference between users and non-users when it comes to what is used here. And our interpretation of this was that, well, the thing is that when people during class use their computers for obviously non-relevant activities, it catches attention. So it's not necessarily that it's used a lot, but when somebody does something that looks at a video or plays a little game that may seem like a very private activity, this shouts out to the rest for attention. So it catches attention much more than just, well, calm or relevant use of the computer. So we interpreted this as a noise source then. You could say that academic irrelevant usage of computers is unpolite to your, well, you can use it, I don't mind if you yourself are disturbed by this, but the problem is it catches attention and works as noise for the rest of the class. So I didn't mean to give this as a lecture in polite behavior during class. That was not the intention. This was just a presentation of this article that I want you to analyze. So it's an individual thing. I want you to, you're going to write a short, maybe 3-4 pages, long hand-in. You're going to hand it in Blackboard. Some have already, actually. By the end of next week, there is an individual hand in this. So the question is, identify independent and dependent variables in these two papers. Say something about what terms are operationalized. How are these variables operationalized, and are they operationalized in a good way in these two papers? And finally, what about reliability and validity? Can you say something about the both the reliability of these studies and maybe some challenges to validity in the two studies? I won't give you examples of this. Don't worry, you won't fail on this hand-in. You will get feedback, and you can hand it in again if you haven't answered it in a good way. So don't worry, it's nothing.